You're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. Today, balancing the budget.
I thought it was an absolutely first-class budget.
What they had in mind was to have a politically oriented budget.
This is the one that brings home the bacon. This is the budget that pulls the whole game together from 1983 onwards.
In the long term, though, this is a really classy budget for the financial markets because it's a genuine surplus.
This budget is designed to meet the big challenges of the future.
On Tuesday night, the Treasurer Joe Hockey will unveil the Abbott government's first budget, one designed to reduce government debt and set us on the path to a balanced budget. Today on Rear Vision, we'll look at Australia's past budgets to see how well our treasurers have done. But first, what exactly is a balanced budget? David Primo is an Associate Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester and the author of Rules and Restraint, Government Spending and the Design of Institutions.
Well, I think there's often a lot of confusion between the idea of debt, deficits, and the relationship between those concepts and the idea of a balanced budget. So a balanced budget occurs when what the government spends in a year is equal to what it takes in taxes and other revenues. Now, if it spends less, you know, it's said to be running a surplus. But as is typically the case, when the government spends more than it takes in, that's when we say it's running a deficit. If that's the case, then to pay its bills, the government has to take on debt. So a balanced budget is essentially the absence of a surplus or a deficit in government spending.
There are several ways, apart from its size, in which a government budget is not like a household budget. Richard E. Wagner is a professor of economics at George Mason University.
The trouble with talking about balanced budgets politically is that there isn't any one person who's responsible for governmental decisions. If you or I borrow and we're slow in paying, we suffer those consequences. But in terms of political entities borrowing, it's not quite the same because there isn't someone who is responsible. The basic ideas with respect to private citizens is each person bears the ultimate responsibility for their choices. When you get to governments, there is no public official who bears the ultimate responsibility because that responsibility is spread over the entire citizenry. And that, I think, is fundamentally a truth in the Western political tradition of the importance of relatively limited government doing important things, but a few number of things, because there is this fundamental weakness of responsibility that is built in the very foundation of government as an entity. I think it would be much better if politicians act not as children, seeking to play Santa Claus, but acting as adults and saying that if I'm going to provide and support this program, I'm going to have to tax you people as well. That's all the gist of the balanced budget idea is, that whenever a politician or a political party says, we want this program, at the same time, you have to say, who is going to pay for it? How are we going to cover the cost?
In democracies, all government budgets are a series of spending plans based on predictions of income and expenditure. They're prepared annually, but operate in a cycle that incorporates elections every few years. Stephen Kukulis is Managing Director of Market Economics, a macroeconomics advisory firm.
One problem with the budget is that a lot of the numbers that we see in a lot of the programs are over 4 years, and that's obviously longer than an election cycle. So what we can often see is that a particular program is going to cost, let's say, $20 billion over the next 4 years, or things like infrastructure spending. Yeah, building a road takes a long time, or the Sydney Airport, another example. It's not going to be finished for another 10 years. So you can announce these things in the budget context or have them costed within the budget context. And you know, the numbers are there, the dollars and cents are there to sort of see that these projects are viable. But of course, a future government can change policy. And perhaps another two good examples of the recent change of government is the mining tax and the carbon price. You know, they were in the budget, of course, under the previous government. And had they won the election, I presume they would have still been there. But of course, we had the change of government. So the Abbott government has come in and trimmed those things out of there, even though some people thought they were very sound, prudent policies. So a policy that's implemented today can be changed by a new government or even can be changed by the same government if it thinks that it's made a policy error, which occasionally happens as well.
Let's have a look now at how well Australian governments have done when it comes to balanced budgets. Treasury have worked out comparable data going back to the early 1970s and the McMahon coalition government, although it's complicated by the fact that some expenditure has shifted since then between state and federal governments.
I thought it was an absolutely first-class budget, every way you look at it. It gives relief to people who badly need it. It reintroduces the idea of childminding centres. It further expands the tapered means test and undertakes to abolish the means test altogether. Now, I really think it's electorally extraordinarily sound from the point of view of vote-getting, but far more important than that, I think it takes the proper economic approach.
The budget's back in the early 70s and even up to the Whitlam years are probably unrecognisable from today's numbers that we're going to be seeing. Because back in the early 70s, government spending and taxing as a share of the economy was only about 17 to 18%. So less than a fifth of the economy was made up by government spending and taxing. Now, and on the budget that we're going to be seeing in the not-too-distant future from Mr. Hockey, we're probably going to have government revenue and government spending at around about 25% of GDP. So we've had the size of government increasing by roughly half from 17 to 25% over the last 30 or 40 years. So that's one part of the change that's obviously been going on. And the curious thing, even for every single budget of the Whitlam years, despite the rhetoric and the misconceptions about how he ran economic policy, and certainly he wasn't a great economic manager, but even within that context, he ran a budget surplus in every single budget that he delivered.
Mr. Crean, as you'll know, has said that he won't talk about his budget, he'll let it talk for itself, but he's practically alone in his reticence this morning. Many commentators have approved many of the budget provisions, although I don't suppose you'll die of surprise to know that Mr. Sneddon, the opposition leader, isn't one of them.
Quite clearly, what they had in mind was to have a politically oriented budget, one which had a nice array of social welfare expenditures. The great shame about it is that those social welfare expenditures will very quickly be overrun by the inflation which they are turning loose.
The critical issue was that was the era where we saw the size of government increase. Yes, there's no question that some of the growth in spending was about 40% in 1 year, astronomical, and a lot of it has actually become entrenched. And in fact, that was the real turning point from the government being relatively small to relatively large. And I guess when you're starting to increasingly fund healthcare, you're increasing pensions and unemployment benefits and these sorts of things that the Whitlam government did, it takes money. The curious thing about it all is that the revenue, the tax side of the budget, more or less kept pace with the expenditure. Remember, it was the high inflation era. Wages were growing by something like 20% per year. And of course, that was rapidly putting people into higher income tax brackets. Companies were making money. And so they were actually collecting a lot of money to cover this increase in expenditure as well. But of course, the problems occurred in the latter part of the 70s when we had a period of really subdued economic growth with very, very high inflation being sustained, that these programs were very expensive. And of course, the revenue started to fall away. And that's when we started to run budget deficits again.
Well, the Federal Treasurer, Mr. Howard, handed down the 1979 budget last night. Let's see what the papers have had to say about it. The Melbourne Age says Howard holds the line. Also in Melbourne, The Sun says tax cuts at last. The Brisbane Courier Mail describes it as a play-it-tough budget. The Australian, give-a-bit budget. And the Sydney Morning Herald, a hard political budget. As for the Financial Review, they say it's a budget for business. The Canberra Times, superficially an appealing budget. The West Australian, a benign budget. And finally, the Adelaide Advertiser, Howard goes for caution.
The phrase is we saw budget deficits, I think, in all but one of the budgets. And of course, going into the end of his time in 82-83, that budget, it was one of the largest budget deficits that we've seen. That was the true and really the only budget black hole, I guess, that we saw. And that was the one that the Hawke government inherited. And even after it ramped up spending to kickstart the economy, it very quickly turned around back to budget surpluses again in the mid to latter part of the 1980s.
This is the one that brings home the bacon. This is the budget that pulls the whole game together from 1983 onwards and consolidates almost everything we've done in that time. It gives us the most potent mix in any budget in the Western world today. That is 12% business investment, 2.75% on consumption, and a public sector borrowing requirement of zero. The last time any set of national statistics would have looked like that would have been in Japan about 1963.
A triumphant Paul Keating describing the strategy of his sixth budget.
The Hawke government got elected in early 83 with the budget in tatters, I suppose you could say. And, of course, we're having a nasty recession. And as we know, with every recession, the government runs large budget deficits. And that's as it should be, because they collect less revenue, they're spending more on unemployment benefits and these sorts of things. And you may recall that a range of other economic policies occurred that forced the government's hand on the budget. And, of course, the floating of the exchange rate in late 1983 meant that as the terms of trade started to fall in 1985 and 1986, the Aussie dollar, which was now floating, fell very, very sharply. And Mr. Keating and others were sort of saying, well, gosh, we've got to do something about our economic policy situation or else we'll end up like a banana republic, that famous quote. So he went and embarked on the most dramatic tightening in fiscal policy that Australia's ever seen. There were three consecutive years where government spending fell in real terms. Never happened before, and it's never happened since. So that caused the budget to return back to surplus. The level of government debt fell to almost nothing. It didn't quite get to nothing. And then, of course, we had the nasty recession that we had to have in 91, 92, which, of course, blew the budget out of the water again.
Okay, so what happened there?
The recession in 91-92 was the worst that Australia had seen since the 30s depression. Unemployment got to 11%. The economy went backwards for basically 2 years. And because of that, the budget, which was in surplus after those tough spending cuts from Hawke and Keating, went into quite substantial deficit. Keating was keen to obviously grow the economy. And you might recall the One Nation program that he implemented, which had a lot of infrastructure spending and the like. And that, of course, by definition, added to government borrowing and caused the deficit to remain high for a period of time. And then, of course, the recovery came. And the best thing for a budget is economic growth, because you're getting people employed, they pay income tax, they spend, which generates company profits, and the companies pay company profits tax. And all this wonderful virtuous cycle occurs in the budgeting process. And so when we got from the period from about 94, 95, and then, of course, with the change of government in early 96, the budget was improving very rapidly. And when Keating lost the election in March 96, the budget deficit was only 1% of GDP. It was relatively small. And Mr. Howard and then Mr. Costello, as his treasurer, delivered a very tough budget in their first budget. I think it was in August of 96. And then, lo and behold, the surpluses were locked in as the economy continued to grow and the revenue flowed into the government coffers.
We have a strong economy which has low inflation, low interest rates, strong growth, a budget in surplus, and we're paying debt back.
The Federal Treasurer Peter Costello, who describes last night's budget as right for the times. In the main points, a buoyant economy sees the delivery of $5.4 billion surplus, resentment in the Senate at budget measures being tied to a GST, dismay about the level of spending on unemployment, and a claim that Australians will change their pattern of health insurance because of the measures announced last night.
Ever since that early 90s recession that we were speaking about, Australia has not had a recession. So basically the period from about 93 through till about 2007 was one where we had strong economic growth. In the latter part of that period, we had very, very strong growth in the terms of trade, the commodities or mining boom Mark One, I think a lot of people describe it as. And that saw the government continually being surprised by the amount of revenue it was collected. It was an odd period where the government would prepare its budget and assume that it would have a surplus of, let's say, $5 billion. 6 months went by and they realised they had a surplus of $15 to $20 billion. The money just kept coming in, not through any deliberate policy action on their front, but just that the economy and, if you like, the inflation pressures that obviously drive government revenue as well were just so strong that every time they checked their numbers, they had more money than they knew what to do with. And we ended up in this period where I think in all but one of the Howard Costello budgets after 97, 98, they were in surplus.
So they didn't spend everything they took in then?
No, they kept some of it. The question now is, did they not save enough of it? Obviously, they set up the Future Fund, which was one, in fact, the only form of saving that they achieved. But you may recall that part of the windfall, if you like, that the government kept collecting on the revenue front, it recycled back into the economy through income tax cuts. Income tax cuts were quite dramatic over that the last 4 to 5 years of the Howard era. And of course, there's a lot of the stuff that we're now looking to trim, and the previous government tried to trim some of it too, in terms of this payments to people on very high incomes, which of course is fine to some extent, but of course when the economy is a bit softer, it's very expensive and very hard to unwind. So there was a lot of money that was given away. Some of it was saved, to Mr. Howard's credit, but arguably a little bit more should have been, because that terms of trade boom was just extraordinary.
This budget is designed to meet the big challenges of the future.
The Treasurer, Wayne Swan, delivering his first budget and the first budget of the Rudd government. Because of the international credit crunch and rising inflation here at home, there was a lot riding on this budget. Could Mr. Swan fulfil all Labour's election promises and rein in a hyperactive economy?
Wayne Swan's first budget has a surplus of $21.7 billion that he's pouring into new investment funds. He calls it a responsible budget that tips the balance in favour of families.
The weakness in the global economy just meant that government revenue, the tax receipts from companies who were no longer making any money, just fell away sharply. We did have this period of very low inflation, which meant that price increases and therefore spending and profitability was also hampered. So from that perspective, the budget was damaged quite severely, so that we went back into deficit simply on those grounds. But also, the policy agenda from Mr. Rudd at the time was to stimulate the economy. It was obvious that the world economy was going into a very nasty slump. The banking sector was grinding to a halt. Banks were failing around the world. And Mr. Rudd, with the wonderful advice from Ken Henry as Treasury Secretary and Glenn Stevens as RBA Governor, decided to spend money to try to limit the fallout from what was obviously just horrendous global economic conditions. It was just a miserable time for the world economy. So what they did, which was, of course, very costly in terms of dollars, but obviously very beneficial in terms of economic growth and jobs, was to spend money on things like the building the education revolution, so that they could have all the infrastructure for the schools. They gave money to people, the $900 checks, so that people spent it and kept the retail sector turning over. That cost an awful lot of money. That was a couple of percent of GDP that was pumped into the economy to grow it, and it caused the budget deficit to blow out to, in fact, the highest deficit that Australia's ever seen.
You're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN, online, on mobile and by podcast. Today, in the lead-up to this week's federal budget, we're looking at the idea of balanced budgets, government taxing, spending and debt. When governments start to borrow and spend too much, there's very little citizens can do about it, apart from at the ballot box, even though they are ultimately responsible for repaying debt. David Primo says that in the United States, at the state level, people have tried to get around this by limiting government spending by law.
All states in the United States, except for Vermont, have some form of balanced budget rules on their books. And they vary in terms of their design and in terms of their quality. And what I found is that states that had the best design rules tended to spend less than states that had weakly designed rules. They also tended to have smaller budget deficits. Now, you might say, well, wait, if they all have balanced budget rules, why would there be variation in the size of deficits? The design of budget rules really matters, and this is something I've studied a great deal. They need to be designed so that they are enforceable and they're not easily evaded. And those are two very difficult features to get into a rule, because elected officials are very good at finding ways around rules, and they're very good at not enforcing the rules if they're the ones doing the enforcing. You know, the saying of the fox guarding the hen house. So it's helpful if there's some sort of external enforcer, perhaps in the form of courts, that can hold the legislature accountable. The U.S. states are very fiscally responsible relative to the federal government, in part because they have these balanced budget rules in the books. Yet the states face their own looming fiscal crisis, and that's in the form of pension obligations to state and local employees. Now, how can they have built up all of these massive obligations to state and local employees when they have these balanced budget rules on the books? Well, the answer is that they have made these promises into the future, but those don't have to be accounted for in the year that those promises are made. They can be accounted for in the future. And so by doing that, right, they've spent the money in some sense today, but they don't have to pay the bill until later. Well, later is coming. And when that bill comes due, we're going to see some significant battles in the states over how to deal with these obligations. So that's another point about rule design that really matters. You know, what is revenue for a government? What is spending for a government? And when do you have to account for that spending?
And is this essentially an accounting problem?
There are many different ways to design budgets, many different accounting methods. And the accounting methods that are typically used don't force a government to account today for its the obligations that it's taking on today that are paid out in the future. And so some economists have tried to estimate, you know, what is the true size of the U.S. federal debt when we account for the promises that we've made? The typical measure of U.S. debt looks at, you know, how many bonds do we have outstanding? But an alternative measure would say, what about not just the bonds we have outstanding, what about the promises that we've made to retirees, to seniors who have health care provided by the government? What's the size of those obligations? And once you factor that in, you sort of start to get a more complete picture of the problems that we face. I think the way in which we think about budgets is part of the problem, that we're only looking at what we're literally taking out of our pockets today and spending, and we're not thinking about the promises that we've made.
There's been another sharp jump in the cost of debt for the Greek government on international financial markets. The interest rate on two-year borrowing has risen to more than 20%, compared with just over 14% yesterday. The spike is a direct result of the credit rating agency Standard & Poor's downgrading Greek debt to a level known informally as junk.
One thing about budgets which is increasingly transparent is that it is a bad economic budget, financial markets can actually punish the government. For example, a currency crisis. Again, you just have to look at the Eurozone and Greece and Ireland, Spain, to see what happens to financial markets when they can see that there's incompetent budget policy in place.
So perhaps this is the one protection for democracies like ours. We're protected in a sense from profligate spending by the markets.
Indeed, that's an excellent point, that the financial markets will be the catalyst, if you like, for any policy problem. When things are good and there's a AAA credit rating and the budget is in good shape, then of course we don't notice it. It's only when there's a crisis that you get the financial markets reacting very adversely. And again, the history and the lessons of the global financial crisis show that only too clearly when we've had various countries with really poor budget settings, really unfunded expenditure for not just a couple of years, but really entrenched. No wonder Greek interest rates went to 200% at one stage. They just couldn't fund themselves. So the markets can punish these countries extremely severely. And in Australia, the way that the transparency is in the budget documents and the way that they're scrutinised by both sides of politics is delivering credibility to the budget numbers. You can be sure that if there was a fudge in the budget numbers a couple of years out, it'd be uncovered relatively quickly and the government would be very embarrassed by that.
Although it's obviously not a great idea to build up massive government debt, how important is a balanced budget?
The notion of balanced budgets is tied to the idea that we want to have a society in which we are not implicitly taxing the future to pay for our consumption today. And that is, in essence, what deficit spending and government debt does. We're pushing the bill out until later, but enjoying the benefits of the government spending today. Now, there might be some cases in which that's necessary. So in times of war, or some would argue during times of great economic struggle, we want to potentially run deficits. But the notion is that we should have, on average, balanced budgets, that if we engage in deficit spending in one year, we should have surpluses in another year so that on average we're not taking on a significant amount of government debt. Because ultimately, government debt can cause significant problems for an economy by limiting investment and potentially strangling economic growth. what's happening in Australia could be an example of politicians being willing to act as leaders and being willing to take a chance on reform and feeling that the moment is right, that they're going to be able to at least push this through and not face pushback from voters. And, you know, there have been some studies that have looked at whether politicians are punished at the ballot box when they take on the budget in a serious way. And these economists have tended to find that they're not punished. The problem with that, of course, is that politicians are strategic and they're going to pick their battles. So you're unlikely to see politicians take on the deficit or take on the budget unless they think that they can do so successfully and not face electoral pushback. So perhaps the conservatives in Australia have thought, you know, this is our time. This is the time we can do this and we're going to be successful and we're not going to get too much pushback from the voters.
In any particular year, there's no importance at all in a balanced budget. It depends. I've used an analogy in the past about balanced budgets. It's like asking, how important is a sunny day? Well, if you're a farmer and you've just gone through 3 years of drought, a sunny day is really bad news. If you're a holiday maker at the beach, a sunny day is terrific news. A balanced budget or a budget surplus, it depends on where the economic cycle is. I think that over time, if we were to have a 10-year rolling average, and I think 10 years is about fair, if the budget is in balance over that period, that's what you've got to aim for. Having a couple of deficits when your economy is a bit weaker or the threat of a weak global economy is threatening your economy and you run a deficit for a few years, that's absolutely fine and prudent. Or if you run a deficit to fund some decent big picture infrastructure spending, that's absolutely prudent as well. But when your economy's strong, when you're growing above your long-run trend and unemployment's at very low levels, then I think it's critical that you be running a budget surplus. So in itself, in any particular year, it matters little whether there's a budget deficit or a surplus, but over time I think it'll be prudent and sensible to be running an approximate balanced budget, even if the odd year you run a bit low or the odd year you run a bit high in terms of a surplus.
Just looking back over the years that we talked about earlier, have Australian governments generally been good at managing that?
I think since the early 70s, we've been very lucky in Australia to have quite prudent fiscal policy settings, good budget policy from both sides of politics. And I was having a little look at that 42-odd years of complete history on budgets. And in those 42 years, roughly half of those years we've had a budget surplus, roughly half we've had a deficit. And if we were to look at the momentum on the budget surpluses, and assuming that we get back to surplus in the next couple of years, which I think is very likely, that if we were to, say, go out to the next 10 years, it'll be roughly 25 years of deficits and 25 years of surplus. And one way to double-check all of that is, of course, look at the level of debt, because each deficit adds to debt, each surplus reduces debt. And as we sit here, the level of government debt is only about 10% of GDP. So it's very, very low. And once we return to surplus in the next couple of years, that level of debt will fall.
And how does Australia compare with other comparable countries when it comes to balancing budgets?
We stand out as one of the best. When we compare ourselves to, say, many of the G7 countries, our fiscal position is outstanding. I don't think there's any other way to describe it. For example, our level of net debt is 10% of GDP. In countries like the US, Germany, UK, it's about 80 to 90% of GDP. So it's about 8 or 9 times larger. And in Australian dollar terms, in today's Australian dollar terms, that's about $1.5 trillion difference, which is a huge amount of money, of course.
Stephen Kukulis, the managing director of the consultancy firm Market Economics. The other people you heard today were David Primo, an associate professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester, and Richard E. Wagner, a professor of economics at George Mason University. Phil McKellar is the sound engineer on Rear Vision today. I'm Keri Phillips. Thanks for listening.
On Future Tense, a leading cognitive scientist on where ideas come from. All animals are able to blend thoughts simultaneously. But what sets humans apart is our ability to process contradictory concepts, he says, and therefore the future itself. We'll also discuss plans to build the world's first truly giant optical telescope. That's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.